At Kelly Companies, it is no secret that they believe in the power of people. In an effort to help their Kellyans get to know each other a little bit better, they decided to launch the Who Do You Know campaign. The goal was simple. Kellyans were encouraged to have a conversation with someone outside of their circle. That's it. These conversations, however, have brought people together and furthered their world-class culture. Shout out to the Kellyans who have made an effort to have meaningful conversations with new friends. You can learn more about those conversations, about those amazing friends, by visiting them online at KeelyCompanies.com.
Welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. John is the number one national best-selling author of the book On Fire. He's a world-class inspirational speaker, and he's the host of the Live Inspired podcast. John interviews extraordinary individuals on their life story so that you can wake up from accidental living and more fully live your life story. Here's your host, John O'Leary.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to the Live Inspired podcast with John O'Leary. Kim Goldman is a victims' rights advocate, championing justice and remembrance for victims. That name, Kim Goldman, may sound familiar to you because her brother, his name was Ron Goldman, was murdered alongside his friend, Nicole Brown, on June 12, 1994. Because of that tragedy and the international media swirl that followed it, Kim found herself thrust into the spotlight while at the same time trying to grieve the loss of her brother. Today, less than a week after the death of O.J. Simpson, I revisit my conversation with Kim. Join us today as we reflect on the parts of her life that were changed permanently, and her feelings on speaking with prosecutors on the case, investigators, witnesses who never got to speak in trial, also with the jurors who voted not guilty. She discusses all of this on her podcast series, Confronting O.J. Simpson. She's going to discuss all of that with us today on our Live Inspired podcast. Plus, she's going to share how she continues to honor her brother by supporting victims and families that face similar tragedies. My friends, this episode reminds us of the non-linear journey of grief, and yet the transformative power of turning personal losses into impactful support for others. It's an emotional conversation. It's a raw conversation. It's going to be intense at some points, and I think it's going to be ultimately the kind of episode that you're going to be extremely grateful you tuned into. So my friends, without further ado, let me loop her in. Her name is Kim Goldman. Kim, welcome to Live Inspired with John O'Leary.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Kim, on almost every other podcast that we do, we begin at the beginning. We begin with birth. In your case, I might talk about Chicago, Illinois. We might talk about a divorce. We might talk about some challenges growing up or battery acid or a million different things that led you to where you got in life. But your life has such a mighty inflection point about halfway through it. June 12th, 1994, you woke up that morning in San Francisco. Is that right?
Yeah, I was in my last semester of college at San Francisco State. I was in a relationship with a gentleman I'd been with a while, working at Wells Fargo and doing an internship at a psychiatric hospital and kind of moving through my life.
Well, the day in your life are going to change profoundly when you get home after a long day. Just take our listeners forward from that point.
So June 12th, it was a Monday, and I was at work at Wells Fargo. I forget whatever my title was. And I left work that day, just normal time, driving home with my girlfriend. She took me home and came into the apartment, and my boyfriend was standing there. In hindsight, now I remember what it was about, but he looked pale faced and you know, panic stricken, and kept telling me I needed to call my dad. And I remember feeling super frustrated. Like, I don't want to call my dad. I just want to go to the bathroom. I want to sit down. I want to go through the mail. And he was really relentless. I needed to call my dad. And this was back in the day when we only had like one landline in the house. And so our phone was in our guest bedroom. And so I, like a girl, was thinking, oh my gosh, we're getting engaged today. So I don't know why that's where my brain went, but so I went willingly into the guest bedroom and did not see a ring. So I figured, I'm already here. Might as well call. And then I called my dad, and Joe was like close up next to me, like wanting to hear. And I was frustrated by that. And then my dad just said, "Did you hear the news today?" And I said, "No." He said, "Did you hear anything? I said, "No." And he, "Do you know who Nicole Brown Simpson is?" I said, "No." And then he just said that Ron was dead. And I remember hearing those words and thinking car accident for some reason. Mm-hmm. And then I just sort of remember spiraling and just kind of falling to the ground. And somehow I ended up back up, and Joe was holding the phone up against me, and my dad was mumbling some stuff. I don't really remember, but basically I needed to get on a plane. And I know I asked him if we needed to identify the body, and he said no. And then I just remember bits and pieces of it. It's like my old favorite quote from Maya Angelou, like, you don't remember what someone says necessarily, but how they made you feel.
Talk about that for a moment. How did that make you feel? We've all lost friends. Many of us have lost siblings. Many of us have lost parents or dear loved ones. Very few of us have had someone murdered in the prime of their life and have had such a shocking conversation with our father. You're expected to be engaged, and a moment later, you're told, get home because your brother's dead.
I think at that point, I mean, we were a very small family, my brother and my dad. I have cousins in Chicago, but we're not very close. My grandparents were not very close. It was you said at the top of the show, there's divorce, and it wasn't just mine. It was my dad's my dad's on his third marriage. And so there's lots of tumult, in our family. And I wasn't really raised with a ton of other strong relationships other than my dad and my brother. And so I never experienced a loss before. I mean, maybe a grandparent, but I was so young. And so I was like, I could not process the words that he was saying. And I joked about it, but I ended up packing like 30 pairs of underwear because I couldn't figure out what do you wear to a funeral. I know I need more than underwear, but I just didn't make any sense to me. None of it made any sense to what he was saying, but you could hear the cracks in my dad's voice and, crying hysterically. And so it forever in that very second, I lost a part of my dad, not only my brother, but a huge part of my dad.
Kim, when did it begin making sense? Not healing type sense, but when did you begin putting together the pieces of what happened and that he was indeed murdered?
Well, it kind of came in steps, I think. I ended up getting home that night. It's a 45-minute flight. My dad met me at the airport with my stepmom and a family friend, and we got into the car, and the radio was on. It was one of our talk radio stations here in Los Angeles, and it said, and in today's news, and it said, Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ronald Goldman were found slaughtered to death in Brentwood. And I think that was probably the beginning of like what is happening. Because I didn't understand that it had been all over the news, because in San Francisco, where I was at, I saw an image of something, but before my brother's face was plastered on the TV. So I did see a little news coverage that day, but I didn't realize what I was watching because they hadn't identified my brother yet. And the news in San Francisco just didn't catch like it did in Los Angeles. And so in LA by that time, it was nonsense. And so, and then all hell broke loose. So I don't know. I honestly it kept coming in waves, like how big this was about to be.
It became, as you are incredibly well aware, that the case of the century and beyond, and you sit through every single day of it. For 479 days from when you first discovered that your brother had been murdered until the jury releases their opinion of a verdict. You're living this every single day, every single moment of each day. You could have, I guess, decided to bury your head in the sand. You could have gone back up to San Francisco. You could have gone up to the mountains and just got lost, but you decide to engage. Why'd you make that decision as a young lady?
I didn't know that I wasn't supposed to do that. I mean, it really wasn't a choice. It just was, of course, that's what I'm doing. I don't know that I ever sat and contemplated my options. I went back to San Francisco just because there was a little break, that's a terrible word, but like in between when we buried my brother and then in terms of when the preliminary hearing and the grand jury. And so I'd gone back up north because I was trying to finish school and, I don't really know what to do. And everyone says, routine is great. And you just got to get back into it. And my boss at the time, who was, very much into sales, he's like, well, just get your sales back up. And I'm like, oh, this is what you do. And so I did all of those things and then was thinking, but I need to be home. And this feels foreign to me all of a sudden, being up here, and the life I created didn't feel safe anymore and didn't feel purposeful anymore. And so I packed up my bag and my cat, and Joe drove me back down to Los Angeles, and I literally moved into my dead brother's room because my room, you know, became, you know, the quintessential exercise room or whatever. So I moved into my brother's room, and there I stayed. And my relationship disappeared, and my schooling I didn't finish, and my focus needed to be elsewhere. And my brother was everything to me. So that was where I needed to be.
October 2nd, you and your family learn that a decision has been made. And October 3rd, 1995, you are in the courtroom. Paint a picture of what that, the rest of the world is watching on their 13-inch black and white TV. You know, everybody's tuning in, but we have a very different perspective than the sibling whose brother has been murdered. And then the individual seated there on the front left side of the courtroom who is charged with the murder. From your perspective, from your lens, what is the courtroom like on October 3rd, 1995?
Incredibly tense. It was really uncomfortable. I remember not feeling like I could find the strength to get over the threshold of the door. I was super anxious, and I did not have the confidence that others did going into it, that we had a conviction. I don't know that I necessarily prepared myself for acquittal. I just don't know that I went in there thinking, oh, we got this. And I think that's just a self-defense mechanism that I put in place, or that was always a part of me. I don't know, but I that's the feeling I walked into, and it was very tense in that room. And the jury came in and they were very stoic, which then I was thinking, they weren't looking at me, you know? Mm-hmm. And I've talked about it a lot, that I was raised in a home where you don't judge a book by its cover. You let things develop, and you come up with what your feelings are about people based on how they present themselves to you. But when you're in a jury situation and you're in a courtroom, you don't have that luxury. So you are monitoring and measuring and evaluating and placing value on every single nuance of a person. Eye rolls, sniffs.
Yes.
Are they looking at the sky? And it's crazy making, to be honest with you. And so I started to attach value to every single thing that these people did for 9 months. And then on this day, I couldn't. And again, some of that, it's just blank to me. But Deirdre, the court assistant or whatever, she was, she said, you know, the verdict. And I remember thinking, I wanted people to be quiet, thinking that my brother's verdict would somehow be different. And then they said not guilty for both. And y'all saw the rest of that.
I've heard you share a couple times that, you know, the dream team that we've all heard and read so much about, that one of the individuals on that dream team, Johnny Cochran, kind of looked over to you and gave you a look.
Yeah, he smirked at me. I remember it. He gave me a look. It was just like a gotcha kind of a look. And that's my belief. I know others have different opinions, but that's my belief.
There eventually is an opportunity for you to leave that courtroom. What is it like, Kim? You walked in that morning with all kinds of emotions, not sure which way this thing was going to go. And now you walk out knowing exactly how it went. It could not have gone worse for you and your family. And most people would say for truth. And now you got to get on, in quotes, with life.
I struggle with certain words like move on, get over it.
Correct.
I wasn't in that place in that moment. I was shocked. I felt betrayed. I felt like I let my brother down. I felt like I had nowhere to go, that I'd have a sense of belonging. All of a sudden, for a very short period of time, you know, the media kind of fell back a little bit. The attention shifted. And then I was thought, what's happening? I mean, I had immersed myself in this. I shouldn't say I immersed myself. I was dropped off into this world that was all-encompassing, and then all of a sudden things shifted and he was out and now the focus was on him. It just, everything was just all over the place. I didn't want to be at home anymore. I went through my savings account. I didn't have a school to go to anymore. I didn't have a job to go to, and I just needed to figure out how to survive. And I'm very grateful and thankful that my dad and I are as tight as we are and that I had a support system that helped me through some of that process. But I think I'm still figuring it out. And it's 25 years later, and you learn to make room for it. That's the best way that I can describe it. I don't avoid it. I don't try to distract myself from it. I don't move on from it. I make room for it because otherwise it'll suffocate me.
Most of us try to do a little bit of the grief work and as we work through things in the quiet of our own heart, whether that's our bedroom, a long walk with family. Yours is the most publicized case in the history of the world. I mean, everyone is talking about it. Everyone's joking about it. Everyone's celebrating what happened that day in the courtroom. And this is your life we're talking about. This is your brother's death we're talking about. This is what's going to happen next for this family that we're talking about. What was that like for you and your family to experience your brother's murder case everywhere, every moment of every day in front of you during that time?
I've never had one, but I would assume it's like having an out-of-body experience. You know, and we have to put in perspective that this was 25 years ago when cable news was just starting. We didn't have 3,000 stations. We didn't have the internet like it is today. We didn't have cell phones the way that we do today. I mean, it was just a different time, and it was still everywhere. It was still everywhere. And people were talking about it, and we would get mail that just said Goldman family, California, and barely having like our zip code on there. And it was just, it was a trip, you know, and sometimes people realize that we were around. Other times you just walk around and people just talking about it. I'm like, hey, that's me. That's my life. Oh, okay. Or I'm watching television and it's popping up on TV and it's a joke on SNL. And then they're cracking jokes on Jay Leno. And I have to tell you, it has shifted over the years, but it still happens today. And so it's this weird feeling of people took ownership, good, bad, or indifferent. They took ownership and they vested in the story like it was their own. And it felt weird to be like, well, wait, but that's my story. And then I softened to it because it represented something bigger than just the loss of my brother to a lot of people. It was about injustice and inequality and racism and celebrityism and domestic violence and victimization. So there's all these other things that people could attach to. And once I realized that, it was a little more heartwarming when the people were kind, of course. When people weren't so kind, then I started to retreat, get a little bit more protective of it. But people connected to the story in a lot of different levels. And I can't take that away. I have to kind of learn how to embrace it because I can't control it, except control the narrative on my end. When I get a lot of slack for participating in interviews or on certain observations of my brother's murder, and then I'm drugging it up and I can't move on. And, you know, why can't you just let it go? And I think, you know, because you're all still talking about it anyway. So I want to control the narrative from my perspective because it is my story. And if I don't, then it just becomes fodder and the random people that don't have any level of connection to it just make crap up about it. And that's hurtful.
So you're controlling the narrative. And part of that piece now is this idea of confronting O.J. Simpson. It's a podcast that you have launched and have done an incredible job producing and sharing. Talk about the genesis of confronting O.J. Simpson. Where did the idea originate?
Actually, it's a very nice segue. It actually kind of originated from me feeling like I needed to have some control over a story that took a leap away from truth and reality, because there have been so many movies and shows and ridiculousness around conspiracy theories and random people claiming that it was them and psychics and documentaries that are based in fiction. And so I was feeling frustrated that there was a whole new generation of people that were tuning into it that weren't getting information from a factual place. And that was important for me to add some integrity to a story that was super important.
Was and remains super important. And I love the fact that you talk not only about the case, about the evidence, about the trial, but also quite a bit about your brother and your family. I love the episode with your brother's friends. What was that like recording your brother's friends talking about his life?
Oh my God, gut-wrenching. One of his friends I'm closer with. The other two, we were Facebook friends, and you know, I chatted with them just periodically. It was gut-wrenching and beautiful and hard and it increased my longing for him. It made me feel closer. I was all over the place. And that was what I wanted, because I think that's a beautiful demonstration of what grief is. So that was important to me. And I always love hearing stories about my brother and hearing other people's perceptions of him and how they impacted his life. And that was a real gift to have them share that with me.
We have our own that moved us. As you listened to what they were sharing about your brother, was there a story that you found in particularly emotional that really captured the essence of your brother?
A little bit from each of them, because I think what each of them shared was the impact that my brother had on them at such a young time in their lives and how meaningful their time with him was, even 25 years later, and, you know, that they still felt parts of my brother with them as they matured into young men and fathers. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, most of us don't always hear how we've left a mark on someone's life. And so this was pretty amazing because my brother probably didn't know any of that because we take it for granted. We don't tell people all the time in our present lives with someone. We, you know, we hope to, but you don't always do that because you just assume you'll be with them tomorrow or you'll show them. And I don't know that my brother knew that. Who talks about that? I love that they feel that connection to him, and that was pretty amazing.
You titled it Confronting O.J. Simpson, and when I hear the word confronting or read the word, it usually seems to me to be combative, and yet that is not at all what I get from these conversations, these interviews, or your use of the word confronting. When you came up with a title, I'm going to call this thing Confronting. Why that name? Why that title?
Well, I had the same exact reaction when it was presented to me, but I think in all of my conversations with the team that I produced it with, that was a theme that kept coming up. And I was very clear that I said, but it's not confrontational.
Right.
And so I was worried that people would add a negative tone to it, but I really do feel like we face things every day and we confront fears and hopes and dreams. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of powerful. And again, it goes back to a little bit of wanting to reclaim some power. And it's reframing it a little bit that I feel was important because that's what I do every day. I confront my life, you know, and I face it head on. And this is just how I wanted to show it.
Kim, I'm going to go through a few of the guests that you had on, and I'd just love for you to share who they are and then a bit about what the conversation was. So some of these are, in some regards, lesser known players, and yet I think their stories matter. So begin with Tom Lane. Who's Tom Lane?
So Tom Lane was one of the lead investigators. He and Phil Van Adder were the two main investigators. Phil Van Adder passed away a handful of years ago, which was heartbreaking. And Tom and I have stayed in contact with each other over the years. And it has always bothered me that he was dragged through the mud and raked over the coals. And I always knew him to be an honorable guy. And I wanted to hear from him how it impacted his life and how it took a turn and how he's fared in the aftermath.
How did it impact his life? And as you get ready to answer that, as I go through these questions, one of the things that jarred me as you interviewed every one of these guests is how they were part of the collateral damage. So your family was directly and permanently forever touched, without a doubt. And so was every single other individual that came into contact with this case.
Yeah. And so I'm glad that you're acknowledging that because that was really one of the main reasons why I wanted to do this, because I think that people have gotten complacent about how it impacted all of us that were involved. And it wasn't just me. It was, like you said, the people that were on the periphery of it. And for Tom, it rattled him. I mean, he's a solid dude, but his face was plastered all over the country and he was deemed a dirty cop and his reputation was sullied. And he talks about how other cases that he would go into a courtroom, how he was treated, and everybody just wanted to talk about the case rather than on the evidence of the new case he was working on and what impacted his relationship with his family and his friends. And I think that we forget that it permeates deeper than we realize.
Talk about Jill Shively.
Jill Shively, she is the witness. She wasn't called to the stand in the criminal case. She was part of the grand jury procedure. She was the one that saw the killer driving away from the scene in a Bronco. He was driving erratically. His lights weren't on. And she wasn't called to the stand because she sold her story. And she was, air quoting, discredited. Because at that time, that was a no-no. You didn't do that back in the day because then suddenly it felt like you weren't worthy of sharing your truth. So she's carried around with her a tremendous amount of guilt, thinking that she was the reason that we lost. So I wanted to let her know that's not what I felt. So that was pretty awesome.
It was pretty awesome. And another conversation that moved me deeply, and I'm sure it stirred you, was the conversation you had with the jury. Could you share with us what it was like even preparing for that conversation?
The preparing was, I don't really want to do this. Right. I know this is important. I need to just plow through it. I can handle it. And that's what I did. I didn't go back and listen to interviews. I honestly never knew what any of them said. That wasn't important to me because I wanted to have an authentic conversation, just us in the moment, and not come in with any predispositions of what I thought they felt or believed. And those were hard. It was awkward. And then I found myself making it comfortable for them, which was important to me. I have gotten some criticism that I was too easy on them. And I thought, my job wasn't to lay them out. My job was to hear them out. So, you know, that's what I did. And I don't know that much changed after that, but I did feel proud of myself for being open to that. And I that was hard though, man. Not going to lie.
The conversation with Lyle in particular.
Yeah, the conversation with Lyle. He was the juror that was widely reported that he put the Black Power sign up in the courtroom. We talked about that. He claims that's not really what he did. And then he sort of, you know, corroborated this feeling that I've always had, which is that the deliberation process was a little bit of a farce and that they already all had their minds made up and that they just sort of wasted 3.5 hours to make it look like they were deliberating.
So not only did they waste 3.5 hours, they invested 9.5 months of their life in this case. For me, part of what stirred me during that conversation was to realize how shaken their lives were. They were removed from their friends, their family, their jobs, their lives, even television.
Yeah. And again, staying with the through line that we don't often pay attention to how it impacts people on the other side. And I did not take that for granted at all as it pertained to the jury. Many of them had to go in hiding, basically, and the media very quickly found all of them and what it did to their professional lives and their family lives and death threats and the hate mail and feel what you feel about their verdict, but that nobody deserves that. And so that was important for me to understand a little bit about what they endured and what they sacrificed. And I feel like I have a couple of different compartments in my heart that I can pull from. And one of which is I can extend compassion to you for what you experienced and the same time, not necessarily appreciate, like respect the way you went, like the outcome that we got. And that was the challenge, but I, you know, that I thought that was important and necessary, but they suffered a lot.
There was a book written and the title of it was If I Did It. There was a ghostwriter for O.J. Simpson that wrote it. And first, let me just begin by saying, I still cannot believe that book was written and published. You got to sit down with the ghostwriter of the book. What was that conversation like?
Well, Pablo Fenves was also a witness in our case, which was interesting for us when we first heard about it, because I thought, wait, he's a witness and he's co-authoring this book. And it was important for me to get an idea from him as to what was going through his mind and his motivation, because I felt very betrayed when I first learned about it, because he was a prosecution witness. How dare he cross over? You know, that was my feeling, but he didn't have any loyalty one way or the other, but I didn't know that. And I was very upset. And so learning about his motivation and what his intentions were, that was fascinating. He's a good dude. He's a business guy. He's an author. And that was his path.
His path crosses over another gentleman's path, Malcolm. Malcolm's the attorney for O.J. Simpson. Your producer reaches out to Malcolm. And they, with his permission, record that phone call. When you heard that phone call the first time, what are your thoughts?
I was mad. I laughed. I was incensed. And then I thought, you know, who the F is this guy? You know, but I think that he demonstrated who he is at the core, and his anger towards me seems so out of place and bizarre, because why are you so angry at me? What did I do? And he's pretty disgusting. And he showed his true colors on, and then just doubled down on our phone call. Just very hateful.
Kim, you mentioned this in passing. You never really got to grieve. You got a phone call from your father. You hop on a flight. You get home. You deal with the first few days of your brother's loss, of the murder, of the burial, and everything else that goes along with that. You go through 4 years of trial cases. You never really, really got to grieve your brother. And so for me, one of the most emotional conversations that you had, and every single one of them was gut-wrenching, but I think the most emotional was with a guy named David Kessler. Who is David Kessler?
Yeah. David Kessler is a grief expert who I remember when I heard about his book, it was his first book or one of his first books was The Five Stages of Grief. And I remember feeling really annoyed that we, you know, labeled it. But once I spoke to him and learned a little bit more about the grief process, and it gave me permission to feel some of the things that I had been feeling and normalize them. And he was amazing. He's just warm and heartfelt and open and validating. And then he just gave me the space to just feel what I felt and not feel crazy about it. And it just was, he's just beautiful. It's probably my favorite.
It is for me by far my favorite. You began to share with him how people say things to you that are just incredibly hurtful. And they don't mean anything by it, but you gave him a list of 10 things that you want to say. Never say these to anybody who are going through a loss, somebody who is grieving. Share with the listeners right now what a few of those, the top 10 things not to say are.
Well, they might be different than what I said at the time, because playing it back, I'm like, oh, I forgot one.
Right.
I am not a fan of it's all part of God's plan. God doesn't give you any more than you can handle. It's character building. You have other siblings. You have other children. I also am not a fan of closure in that sense of offering it to me as the solution. And again, I could go on and on and on, but those are probably like my top feelings about it.
Mm-hmm. For someone who is going through loss, and that's the vast majority of our listeners right now, we're dealing with something that we are carrying around, that we are living with each day. What encouragement or advice might you offer them as they wrestle with where they've been, what they're dealing with, and how to move forward with it?
Give yourself permission to move forward with it. And it doesn't look the same for everybody. Grief, in my experience, takes on lots of different shapes and colors and sizes. And some days it's more present than others. And that all has to be okay. And at different times in your life, it's going to rear its ugly head because that's what grief does. Yeah, I talk a lot about my son, and I didn't realize that grief was going to come up a lot again, because now I have a kid and I'm walking through life with him by my side and recognizing what I'm missing because my brother's not around and what he's missing, having never met his uncle. And I didn't know that was going to happen before because I didn't have a kid before. So now I have to manage that. And one of the things that David Kessler said in the episode is that, you know, grief must be witnessed because the love must be witnessed. And that was so freeing. It was so freeing because people are uncomfortable with grief. It makes us feel bad. It makes us feel scared, and it makes us feel helpless. But those of us that are in it, we don't want to feel isolated. And most of us don't need a fancy word or a special phrase, just some quiet sometimes, just some acceptance of it. And I don't know, every day is a little different, and don't be afraid to ask for support. And even if you don't know what that looks like.
You asked him specifically about joy and happiness and peace, and I forget exactly how you framed the question, but you essentially said, do you think that those of us who've gone through a tragedy, those of us who are dealing with grief, are not going to have the same level of joy and happiness going forward? And he essentially said, no, not at all. It doesn't steal your joy. It actually expands it. And he talked about how those emotions stretch you.
It's ironic because a friend of mine lost her son suddenly a couple of years ago, and she was listening to the podcast, and she was listening to that episode, and she said to me, it gave me permission to like laugh in the car, and it gave me permission to find humor in things and not feel like I wasn't honoring my son. And she said, because people look at her and they think, oh, she has a smile on her face, she must not be sad anymore. That's a real misperception, you know, about people that are grieving, that if you seem joyful, then you must be done. I've always struggled with that because I don't want people to ever think that I'm done grieving, because you're not. There's a real internal battle. And so when he offered that freedom and explained how you could have grief and still have joy, I'm like, yeah, that's it.
Well, literally, you were talking over him saying that, like, finally, someone who is telling me what I've known for 25 years.
Yeah, I was never a support group, ironically, because I was a psych major and that's what I do for a living. But I was never a support group girl. Like, that did not work for me at that time. I didn't want someone to tell me that what you're feeling is normal. I knew that because I was feeling it. I didn't feel abnormal for what I was feeling. I couldn't articulate it. And when people wanted information and wanted me to share, I just couldn't find the words, and it all just seemed so illogical. And then the way he put things, I'm like, yeah, that's what I've been trying to say for 25 years. So thank you.
Kim, you interviewed many of the individuals involved with the case at one level or another. Who do you wish you would have had an opportunity to confront, to sit in front of and to speak with about the case?
I think probably one of the defense attorneys, as much as I would have struggled, I think wanting to understand not necessarily specifics about the case, but just more the lack of integrity. And I think the lack of tact and compassion that they didn't extend. I understand the difference between needing to have a strong defense, but I didn't think that they needed to take it to the level that they did. And with such veracity that I think I wanted to talk about that. But I don't know. I guess this show could go on forever. I'm curious about all of it.
Mm-hmm. If you did have an opportunity to sit across from O.J. Simpson, what would be your first question to him?
I don't know. When he was in prison for the crimes from Vegas, there was something powerful in me wanting to see him behind bars. There was something very empowering about me being the one to be able to walk away after seeing him in his orange suit and handcuffs and shackles or whatever. And it was a visual for me. It was never a conversation that I wanted him. I don't have questions for him. What could he possibly say that would make any difference to me? But as I've matured through all of that, and being that now he's not in prison, and if I ever come across him, I think most of it would sort of hover around his angst for me and my brother and our family, and this whole concept of he's searching for the real killer. But why are you so mad at my brother? My brother tried to save the mother of your children. I don't understand, which just again is just me being sarcastic, really, because I know the answer, because he killed him. I think there's just a visceral reaction that I would have, and I don't know what would come up. Maybe I do have a ton of questions that I haven't thought about, but nothing seems pressing.
So you are 2 years older than I am. I was 18 when this happened, and remember the case, remember following it, remember learning about your brother. But I didn't know him. How can I know Ron? And then at the very end of your podcast, you played the answer machine that were left on the final day of his life. First, I wept listening to these recordings of friends and family members. Hey, Ronnie, let's go out, and just life, right? And then as they pivot. So my first question around this is, why did you save those messages?
Because it was the last pieces of him. That's just it. They were the last pieces of him. And it was important for us to hold on to as much of him as we possibly could. They're powerful. And it really does. I mean, you say it exactly. It's the pivot. It's his life and his death all wrapped up into a 30-second moment. And it's incredible and it's amazing. And I wanted to honor my brother's relationships with his friends and the impact that he had on their lives. And I just thought it was a touching way to kind of wrap it up from where we started.
As you've shared these podcasts and these messages and these interviews, what bit of feedback has surprised you most from the listeners?
Predominantly, the feedback has been really powerful and wonderful and amazing and supportive, and it's been so humbling. Sometimes it's the critics that I hear the loudest, and so there's, of course, those people that tell me I'm just profiting and it's blood money and I'm, to quote the killer's attorney, I'm dancing on my brother's grave and his blood, and then I'm a professional victim. But most people have been incredibly supportive, and their experience was, this is not what I expected. This is not the same old thing. It came from a very different place. And they felt the compassion that I was feeling.
Right.
So that was to me. And so I'm choosing to hang on to that stuff.
Well, they may call you a professional victim. I would call you now a professional advocate. It's what you've been doing for 25 years. Many people would become professional victims, or at the very least, bury, put on makeup, mask it and move on in their lives. You have not. You've embraced this. So my question to you before we pivot into the final seven questions, we call them the Live Inspired Seven, is talk about the decision to lean in and to advocate and to allow this experience that has robbed you of so much of the joy that you would have experienced to be used as a platform to support others as they go through their own experiences.
I don't know that it was a decision necessarily as much as it was a calling, and then a moment of sort of like how I knew I needed to be in the courtroom. It was just, there was no other place for me to be. And I think that I felt so overwhelmed with the connectedness I felt to other people that had suffered this similar loss, and learning about injustice and learning about the inequities across the country, that I was like, oh, how, half this is wrong. And have to do something. I can't be the only one. And then I learned that I wasn't. And so I went along with it because it spoke to me. And then there was a moment that I needed to pull back because I realized that I hadn't processed my feelings and I was feeling very overwhelmed by all of the attention and feeling like I didn't earn my spot yet because I was still so deep in my grief. And I retreated until I felt stronger. And now I feel more confident in it because now I've honed in on my coping, but there's so much work to be done. And there's so many of us out there that have been wronged in some way that I just feel like I have to do something. I just don't know how to not.
Well, you are doing something. And my understanding is every time you hear a wind chime, you are reminded of your brother's voice, of his joy, of his life, of your connection together. When you hear those wind chimes, what does it stir within you about your brother?
You know, my spirituality and my beliefs have shifted. I'm all over the place. One day I believe, next day I don't. But I choose to hold my brother in a very high regard. And I choose to look for him in lots of places in the world. And I had a psychic one time tell me that the wind chimes outside my window is my brother speaking to me. And I thought, come on, it's the wind. That's why wind chimes are a big sound. And I have no idea. But that felt very peaceful to me because I love wind chimes. So I just choose to attach meaning to that. So I just hold him close. I have a picture of him in my car. I wear his necklace and his ring because it keeps me connected and it feels safe. And I talk about him as much as I can and share stories as much as possible. And I try to emulate things about him that were important. And I want to pay honor to him.
When you look at Sam, do you see Ron?
I do see my brother and my son. It trips me out. and the poor kid, there are character traits. It's one of those things. It's like that whole concept of, does it carry on into the next, you know, does life pass over and reincarnation? I don't know what I believe about that, but it does freak me out that there are things about my son that remind me of my brother. And there's just little moments or he'll walk by and I'll see a glimpse of him. His eyes very much remind me of my brother and his spirit is very similar to his. It pains me because I know that they'd be the best friends.
Kim, when we have the honor of having a guest on our show, we ask all of them, whether they are astronauts, writers, or experts in life like you are, 7 questions that tie all of our guests together. So I'm going to go through these 7 questions with you. We call them the Live Inspired 7. The very first one is, what is the best book you have ever read?
Oh, dude. What came right to my mind is Tuesdays with Maury.
What is it about Tuesdays with Maury that you say, gosh, John?
Because it was so real and so honest and so relatable, and it erupted something in me that at that time was what I needed, and it was just permission to just weep openly.
Well, we had Mitch on this podcast, and one of the things he said is he learned that from Maury, this idea of weeping openly and dancing when you're happy and not apologizing for living boldly, and certainly you've carried that forward. What's one positive characteristic or one trait that you possessed as a little girl that you wish you exhibited as brilliantly today?
You know, I know this is going to sound like silly, but I've always been an old soul. And I think I was this when I was a little kid. Like, I was the kid that knew I wanted to be a child psychologist when I was like 6. I think I wish that I would have maybe been a little bit more playful. I was very serious. I was very responsible. I was very book smart, and I wish that I would have given myself a chance to just not be all of those things for a little while so I could just let loose a little bit more.
You're not alone. Question number 3 is, if your home caught fire and Sam and the animals, all the things that matter like that are out, the animals and the people, and you have an opportunity to grab one item, what's the one thing you would grab?
I have a box of photos of my brother and our childhood that over the years I've taken out of photo albums. And so now they're all in a box. That would be what I would grab.
Kim, if you could sit on a bench overlooking a beach and have a long, long, long conversation with anyone living or dead, who would you want to be seated next to on that bench?
My brother.
What is the best advice, whether it was from Ron, your father, or anybody else that you respect that you've ever received?
Be true to your core. Be authentic. Don't apologize for who you are. At some point in my life, all of those messages have been told to me and they resonated with me. And I hope that I am putting that back into the world because that has made a difference for me.
What would you tell your 20-year-old self? And this is before that phone call, before you left San Francisco on that evening flight. What would you tell yourself as a young lady with your entire life in front of you and everything going pretty great?
You got this. You can handle it. I think I would just remind myself that I've always had inherently those strengths and those abilities to be able to cope and to persevere. I've had a lot of crap happen in my life and I know that about myself. And so I think I would just serve a reminder upon me that I can handle it and I'm going to be okay.
Kim, the final question is, it has been said that all great people can have their lives summed up in one sentence. How would you like your one sentence to read?
It probably would have something to do with having courage and honor. I am really proud of myself for living a life of integrity and honor and grace. I think that I have faced my life with courage and I'm proud of me for that. And I'm still learning. I know that's a long sentence, but I didn't take a breath. So it's just a run on.
Those are commas, not periods.
Commas, exactly. And humor. I think humor is incredibly important. So I don't know. Make that all work?
No, that's perfect. and if you could, 7.2 is this. If you could write that sentence for your brother, if you could tell our listeners, man, this is the sentence that sums up my brother's life. What would you say for him?
Heroic. My brother proved who he was in the last few minutes of his life by not running from danger, that he's a fierce protector up until his last few minutes trying to save his friend. And he lost his life, and I think that's pretty heroic.
My friends, I think it's pretty heroic, too. We've had an opportunity today to spend some time with Kim Goldman. Kim, I want to thank you for being heroic in your life.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me. And, you know, those are one of those moments that I get to emulate my brother and what he taught me, and I feel very lucky.
My friends, that is Kim Goldman. I am John O'Leary, and today is your day. Live inspired. Well, my friends, if you enjoyed my conversation with Kim Goldman, you may also enjoy a conversation we had a couple years ago with another one of our friends. Her name is Maddie Jackson Seligman. Maddie shares her deeply personal journey after the tragic and completely unexpected loss of her husband. Relying on her faith, Maddie's journey is a reminder that no heartbreak, no loss is unredeemable. By confidently clinging to hope, we can, in fact, in time, truly heal. It's one of my favorite podcasts. It's one of our most listened to podcasts. And I think you'll know more about why that is the case when you check it out. It's at episode 428 with Maddie Jackson Seligman. Or you can let your fingers do the walking and join me right now on the website at johnoleary.inspires.com/podcast. We'll have in the show notes for this episode a direct link into that Maddie Jackson Seligman conversation. My friends, I want to thank you as I do each and every week for tuning into the Live Inspired podcast. I want to thank you for being part of our podcast community. And I want to remind you of something that the mainstream media may forget to remind you of tonight. You ready for it? The foundation is firm. Your life is a sacred, precious gift. The headwinds might be real, but your best is yet to come. So for this time and until next time, my name is John O'Leary, and today is your day. What a gift. Live inspired.
You know that Keeley Companies is all about fostering the world-class culture through their incredible cultural pillars. Well, it was time to add a seventh cultural pillar, Keeley Green. Guided by the mission to raise the sustainability standards by which they design, build, operate, and live, Keeley Green is dedicated to using a holistic approach to leave a positive impact on our environment, create a future that is sustainable for generations to come. In the words of Rusty Keeley, we are just getting started. You can learn more about that just getting started mentality and all the work they do by visiting my friends at Keeley Companies online at keeleycompanies.com.